Hey, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Hello and welcome back to Action Jacks. I'm Kamal Ricky on the board. SB Futures up 23, NASDAQ Futures up 98. We have Professor Carl.
Yes, we do.
We do. I hear you. I don't hear him.
You do.
There
I'm
he is.
Here.
All right, bud. What's the word?
Well, you know, Florida's going to get a blowjob.
Yeah, this is a. It's going to connect the dots between the last two, right?
Well, you know, the screaming coming from the media and you know,
climate change.
Excuse me, 2004 called and would like its year back. I lived in Florida for 20 years, as you know, and as I've pointed out for a long time. In fact, I started this column in 2007 that I write, right into the maw of the housing crash. And where I was largely ground zero for all the pre-construction condo flipper craze. Okay.
Where exactly were you?
I was in Niceville, which is on the other side of the bay from Destin. I had a bayfront house, so I was directly exposed to the potential for really bad things when tropical weather shows up. And Panama City was probably the centroid of the stupidity from a standpoint of the pre-construction flippers. I successfully resisted the temptation and, of course, all the sales jobs trying to get me involved in those. Very glad that I did. I had a realtor friend of mine that was one of the people pushing that stuff. And unknown to a lot of people at the time, I don't know how if the model's changed at all or not, probably hasn't, but they don't get paid until there's a closing, okay? So they
that's still a deal with real estate people.
Well, generally, yeah. Pre-construction's a little weird because you're putting a deal on the board that hasn't been built yet, right? And so he had quote unquote sold all these things that were going up. Well, of course, when it all went down the toilet, none of the buyers closed, none of the deals happened, and
A lot of people, I mean, you're more familiar with me, but and that kind of stuff, isn't there pretty good deposits that are down?
So the way it typically works is it's about 10% that you have at risk. And then when, you know, there's milestone points by which you have to have the financing locked up to be able to do the rest.
Okay.
So, and the problem is that when you get to those points, if there's no, you know, if there's no economic argument for doing it, okay, then, you know, everybody either puts the finger up or gets told by the bank no on the, you know, on the permanent financing, and oops, right? So there were a lot of oops, and but this was a couple of years before that. I'm sitting in my house on a Saturday morning, and there's a knock on my door. I'm literally in my bathrobe, Chief. I mean, I haven't even gotten.
I can
a
see you in
yet,
one of those big long bathrobes with the pipe, smoking the pipe and everything.
Well, I wasn't smoking a pipe, but I was drinking my espresso, and there's a bang bang on the door, and it's some realtor chick that's she's parked on the side of the road, and says she has a couple in the car and they want to buy my house. Well, it's not on the market.
What difference does it make? Is it always a price?
Well, and I looked at her and I said, look, I'm well aware that there's a, you know, a crazy bubble going on right now. I said, you know, you want to buy the place? I said, that's fabulous, except for a problem. We're going to have to overpay for a replacement. How's this do me any good?
Well, yeah.
I get a permanently stepped up basis on my, because Florida has a weird property tax system. I said I get a permanently stepped up basis on this. Now, if I want to leave Florida, it would make some
this
sense.
This is where you give them a price, and if they take it, they take it.
I did, and it was a stupid price, as you might imagine. And she's like, well, I said, look, do you see a for sale sign out in front? I said, you know, I'm a whore. All I ever argue about is money. Yeah, you know, there's always a number at which, yeah, I'll be out in 30 days. So, but no, it's, you know, what's old is new again. I think the biggest change here now is that the politicy, the turning everything into a political thing and all for clicks, because, you know, that's only gotten 100 times worse, right?
Yeah.
You know, the idea that Harris is running around saying that, well, you know, DeSantis won't take my phone call. Excuse me. First off, you're the vice president. I don't care if you're running for president or not. You have no operational control of anything that a state governor needs in, you know, in terms of getting in front of a hurricane. And he's a little busy right now. So if you don't like the fact that his job is not to either interfere with or get involved in your attempt
But he is looking for, he better be looking for a lot of money from the federal government because he didn't have enough.
Well, so Florida has, I will say this, they are very well organized in terms of mutual aid and you know, with the power companies and things like this. They're also quite well organized in terms of keeping the idiots out of the picture until they've actually got some kind of a level of response that makes some sense. But this is something that the people up in North Carolina and around here, you know, the conspiracy theories that are running about, you know, FEMA is you know, trying to kill people and stuff like this. Look, the reality of the situation is that in most cases, and having lived in Florida for 20 years, I've seen this, they'll be happy to show up and hand you out boxes of MREs and stuff like this about a week after it's over. If you think the federal government is going to manage to pull off anything successfully when, you know, the day after the storm happens, you're out of your effing mind.
They're not gonna, well, one of the issues, actually, my general lives in my building. Was telling me he's been in Florida helping his brother clean up from the last one. And he showed me a video of the street, the stuff on the street, every washing machine, every sofa, every,
right,
you name it.
Well, that's one, well, yeah, because you have to get all the water, you have to get anything that got wet out of the place immediately.
Yeah, and now the governor was saying, or somebody was saying, that one of the biggest issues before this thing hits is to get all that crap away because it's going to end up in the air flying at people.
Well, yeah, and so Pinellas, which is in a very blue part of the state, shut down a couple of days ago their runs and their, you know, the dump area, right? You know, all counties have them. Well, they shut theirs down, and DeSantis ordered it reopened, and the trucks to get in there and get that crap off the roads and, you know, and out, because, you know, everybody pulls the stuff out, puts it on the side of the road.
Are the dumps ready for that volume? They can't be.
Oh no, they are. They're ready for it normally, and because you know every summer these storms happen. All right.
The dumps around Chicago would be ready for half the appliances in the city. All of a sudden, get dumped in there.
Oh, you'd be surprised at how well these guys actually manage to, you know, get staged and be ready for this kind of thing when the summer comes around. But the Florida guys actually went down there with a couple of F-250s and chains and pulled the gates open.
Well, so what is long term? I mean, if you're going to trade any of this stuff,
right? Yeah, there is certainly an economic angle to this.
Well, I mean, we've got what does this say to this, the future of the state of Florida? I mean, we had how many
1,000 people lived in these areas, maybe a million, millions. Is anybody going to get insurance? Is the entire country insurance going to go up? Is there a point where everybody's moving to Arizona or what?
Well, so Florida, from a property insurance point of view, Florida has been hived off for a long time. And the main companies that write property insurance, you know, the State Farms and the Allstates and those guys, they've all done this. They've all set up pup companies, which are not technically part of their main mutual pool. And the reason they've done it, and this was the case 20 years ago when I lived there. I'm sure it's only gotten worse. And from what I've read, it certainly has. Is that even back then there was a corruption problem down there, and a lot of it is just due to the fact that the economic angle on this, from the state's perspective, favors them never going after anybody on a criminal basis for any of this.
What do you mean, anybody? You mean the builders, the insurers, or anybody?
Well, everybody involved in putting stuff up and doing, you know, maintenance and repairs, you know, all the contractors. And I mean, the after every one of these storms, you see places that were put up allegedly after the code changes, you know, that were made after Andrew. Okay, Andrew was horrid down in South Florida.
Well, Andrew wasn't horrid. You ever see that place, Homestead?
Well, yeah, but the thing is that the vast majority of the places that got flattened, and the entire areas got flattened by that storm. The vast majority of them were literally Cracker Jack boxes.
Sure they were.
Okay, and so, you know, no surprise that when a big hurricane comes through there, they get destroyed. And Florida very substantially tightened up the codes after that event. But an awful lot of the stuff that got wrecked didn't even meet the code of the time, right? And yet, of course, it had sign-offs that, you know, that it had, right?
Did you actually ever go down there? I did.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. I've been down there. I know exactly where. Yeah, I've been there. So the problem, though, that you have with this from a state enforcement perspective, and this goes to, you know, to much that we talk about all the time with grift and fraud and all of this, is that from the state's point of view, from an economic point of view, if a huge hurricane comes through somewhere and destroys half of a village, right, and it has to be rebuilt, that's GDP.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay? Now, you're the one that you know, gets the hand grenade up your keister, but from a state's, "Hi, my economy is booming" point of view, it's GDP. That's a problem. Nobody ever goes to prison for this, and every time there's one of these storms, you see roofs that are in the middle of the street, frequently in pieces. By the way, those pieces have this nasty way of going through your picture window, whether you have shutters up or not. And the problems are instantly evident when you look at that, because the hurricane straps are supposed to be there, obviously not, because now the roof is in pieces and you can actually see whether or not they were there. The secondary membrane that's supposed to be underneath the shingles isn't there. This was all signed off on as inspected and having been done. The guy actually never got out of the truck. I put a dock in my place, and the guys, you know, of course, all permits and everything else. The guys that ran the power out to the dock did it wrong at the main and the sub panel. And I found it because I went to put a whole house surge suppressor in because I got a bunch of computers. I don't want to get blown up. I mean, you know, Florida's also the lightning capital of the world. And I called the guy's name, the inspector's name from the county. And it basically said, "Hey, you know, Mr. Blankety Blank, you realize you could turn me into an effing hot dog out there on my own dock when I go to turn the power on or off." And I'll call. I said, "You're not calling anybody. You never got out of the truck. If you'd taken the cover off the panel board, you would have seen this. You obviously did not, which means you signed off on the job and you never looked at it." And that's the problem, okay? Now, no one goes to jail for this kind of stuff, and the county officials that sign off on this and never actually looked at it, They're just as responsible as the contractors that aren't doing it right.
Well, the homestead situation, I have had a long-dead aunt whose father grew up in, like, Hammond, Indiana or someplace, and he decides to move to Florida.
Yeah.
He didn't have any money, so he goes to this place in Homestead. So I'm down there at spring break, right? My aunt demands that I go look at the house. Because he's dead, and she's renting the place out. And
right.
I drive down there, and I'm going, God bless, this is like something from the third world.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was these little frame places with, like, one window air conditioner. Every washing machine, every car you owned were either in the driveway or still on the porch. That kind of thing. It's like going through Arkansas or someplace.
Oh, and it looks...
But, I mean, I could have walked up and shoved the house down. I mean, it was...
Oh, yeah. No.
But those things, there's no way you all of a sudden institute building codes that people are paying $200 a month rent.
Oh, no. Absolutely, Chief. But you know, I mean, but the thing is, you had a bunch of Cracker Jack boxes, okay? And the state allegedly got serious about it after that happened. But the truth is, it's a paper tiger if nobody enforces it. It's like anything else.
In Homestead, did the same people end up there? Or are they all gone? Or, I mean, is it now a decent place? I'm going to say decent, a more modern place, or is it just empty?
I don't think it. I wouldn't call it decent, but I mean, obviously, the stuff that was there was destroyed. So, you know, there was, you know, things were rebuilt. But the bigger issue, though, that goes along with this is that, you know, people want to live on the water. They want to live with this, where this kind of a situation is. You have billions of dollars of real estate on barrier islands, which is stupid, okay, in the first place. And then what goes along with that is everybody that has some money wants a boat, especially if you live in Florida.
Why not?
Well, and, yeah. You know, okay, fine, except... When the storm comes, they all run away. They don't secure it properly. Taking care of the boat's not the biggest deal. You know, getting out of the, you know, out of the way of the incoming storm is. And now you have a 20-ton pinball that gets loose and goes bashing around into anything it can hit. And oh, by the way, the water is, you know, 10 feet higher than it usually is. So what it can bash includes your house. And so, you know, I mean, think about having, you know, pinball.
Speaking about water higher, why the storm that hit 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago?
Yeah,
the storm surge was like 15 feet, and even though this thing at one point was a Category 5, they were talking about 8 feet. Is that a tidal difference?
No. So there's a bunch of stuff that happens during these. The exact angle of approach and where you are and the topography of the land makes a huge difference. It very small changes in those things can make for enormous differences in outcomes when it comes to surge. Tampa Bay has not been hit by a storm it's just an accident of geography in the way the land runs over there. It has not been hit by a direct approach in well over 100 years. And the glancing blows don't really do a whole lot, but if you get one that rams water on the dirty side, on the side that's rotating towards you, up into Tampa Bay, you're going to get 10 to 15 feet of water in downtown. And the same thing happened in Pensacola when Ivan came in. Ivan was just west of Pensacola, went in Perdido. And the surge up Pensacola Bay was actually sufficient to lift the bridge, two of them, one down at the bottom and one about 10 miles up the bay, lift the bridge spans off their supports and throw them in the water.
Whoa.
Okay, so, I mean, there is nothing. If you get hit by that kind of surge, I don't care what you built, it's going to get wrecked. All right? Oh, yeah. And there is no way you could build to withstand that. I mean, you go ahead and hide from the wind, but if the water's coming, you get the blank out of there or else, because you're going to get killed if you don't. And it's deadly serious stuff. And people, you know, this is, you've got people that want to live in these places, and then there's all the screaming when these things come. Well, guess what? Hurricanes are a fact of life if you live in an area where that can happen. And you have to make, you know, you have to make a lot of decisions, okay? When I bought my place down there, I took the lay of the land, which direction it was facing, What kind of elevation did I have? You know, all these things. Yes, I wanted to be on the water, but I also didn't want to end up having, you know, just 5 feet of it in my living room either. Well,
my sister-in-law has a cousin. I don't know if I ever met her. I probably did once, but she has a place down in where did the first one hit? Like Naples, that area.
Yeah.
The condo, and of course, the people. I don't know what they could have done, but I guess I'm going to say they're so dumb, they evacuate and leave cars, like, in the parking lot.
Yeah, which is really stupid, but that's what people do.
Also, when the surge came, the cars were banging into the fifth story of this condo building.
Yeah.
And so the place is pretty much wrecked. It's been 2 years. They still don't have an insurance decision as to whether they're going to try and rebuild the place or condemn it. Can't get in your place still. Maybe you could have got in and got some stuff out of there. I'm not sure, but elevators don't work. Power doesn't work. What do you see going forward? If I paid $400,000 for a place, am I going to say screw it and puke it out at $200,000 to somebody who's just going to self-insure or what?
Well, yeah, that's you know, the way this used to be down there is that if you were on the barrier islands and the stuff, you know, Mexico Beach and the up in the Big Bend and things like this, people stuck what amounted to cinder block shacks there, and you know, if those places were today what they were then, you know, they might sell for $100,000, and they weren't fancy. They had, you know, maybe $10,000 worth of stuff in them. The storm comes and it floods the blank out of it, shoves a bunch of sand inside. And you show back up, you shovel the sand out, you get the pressure washer out, you pressure wash the wall, well, and, you know, and dry it out, and life's good. The problem is, now this stuff's all gotten dolled up, or even worse, you took a Cat D8 to the site and then put a Taj Mahal on there, and now you've got a $5 million property that gets ruined.
Well, some of the stuff that's on, we took a tour of Miami in one of these little boats, Miami Harbor, when we were down there, when I was doing this stuff for the CBOE. And what's that island place down there where they had the Miami Vice was filmed there and everything? The houses on that island are unreal.
Oh, Miami Beach and up towards Palm Beach and stuff like that. Yeah, it's, and Jupiter. That area is insane. And it has been for a long time. But it's only gotten worse. And the West Coast is the same way. I mean, there is...
Well, people, when Fari Hamzi used to do a show with us, we had dinner with him the other night. When he moved down to the west coast of Florida, he was absolutely convinced that side was hurricane-proof.
No, it's not.
What? Duh. I sort of get that now. I mean, matter of fact, I was giving him crap that he cursed the place by saying that. But the bottom line, though, is if the prices are going to have to be, people are going to have to be set to self-insure in some of these areas. Now, if you're in a condominium complex, I don't think you can self-assure because the place is going to go out and get the money no matter where it is. I heard rumors from somebody last night, $130,000 assessment for the insurance and something for one of their play. But who the hell's got that kind of money?
Well, what's happened down there, I think it was Surfside was the name of the place, the condo building that collapsed. Part of the problem you have down there is that, of course, you know, any kind of significant structure has ongoing maintenance and, you know, and engineering costs, right? Nobody likes large assessments. So you have a lot of game playing that goes on with that work not being done. You have revisions and improvements to things like, you know, well, you know, we want to redo the pool deck because we want some nice planters and make it more pretty and da 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 whatever. But they didn't bring the engineers in to see, oh, by the way, that, you know, that extra 40 tons of planters that you're going to put on the deck, well, is the stuff under that up to that job? You know, that's not important. We don't have to worry about things
right,
like
right.
That.
Just,
right,
just keep playing on that.
Yeah, everything will be fine. And then of course, it's not. So a lot of this is deferred maintenance. The state got very nasty about this after that collapse for obvious reasons. I mean, you know, people got killed. And so now these associations and, you know, they're run by the homeowners after it's, you know, turned over, that have not done this stuff. There's 20 years or 30 years worth of deferred engineering work and maintenance on these places, and it's $200,000 a unit to get caught up on it. The valuation on many of those places is negative.
Well, what? So if I'm down there and I had a place, and say I had the, you know, the $350,000 to put in there, and I say, you know what, I'm out on Florida. I'm going to Arizona, or I'm going someplace. What am I going to get for my place?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe nothing, right? I mean, that could happen.
$150,000?
Well, maybe. Yeah. I mean, it's
so that person has to come in. Essentially, now if it's a condo unit, he can't really self-insure. But if it's a house, he can just get it for a cheap enough price, fix it up, hope he manages to last till the next hurricane comes, right?
Right, and you know, this is the screaming though about how we can't let that happen, and you know, the government needs to bail everybody out because you made a bad choice, and you know, you took a gamble. Well, you know what I mean? I took a gamble being on the water, and
well,
and
what
there
about
are
the people that have insurance, and the insurance companies are very reluctant to pay.
Well, that's the other thing that happens is you get the lawsuit lottery games that start. The ambulance chasers always show up within seconds. Florida has a very weird thing that allows these things called public adjusters, and they show up after all these storms. They get paid a piece of the settlement on the coverage when you have an insured loss. And so, needless to say, there's all kinds of game playing that goes on there. I mean, there's the layers of corruption involved in this are mind-boggling, and it's one of the things that caused me to leave the state, because I saw the multiplication effect of this along with the valuations, and between property taxes and insurance, that's a tax on ownership. I did a column on this the other day that was not specifically related to storms, but it is related to this problem, which is that if you think about, you know, a place that has $15,000 a year worth of, you know, of these costs, okay, and you say, well, you know, that's $15,000, okay, and by the way, that's not hard to do in somewhere like Chicago or the Northeast either, right, between taxes and insurance, right? So, all right. So that's, you know, that's $12.50 a month, right? So that's what you have. And let's say that you capitalize that back at 6%, okay? Do you have any idea how much that actually is in terms of the principal value?
Well, that's what, I mean, your house is here in Chicago, and you see the taxes going up. I mean, if you... God bless, if it's 8%, you just drop the price of the house by 15-20%.
No, Chief, it's worse. The tax and insurance problem, here's the thing. The imputed value of that, let's say that it's $15,000 a year. The imputed value of that, if that was a P&I payment, is $208,000.
Well, yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
But the thing is this. All right, so the general rule of thumb has always been that you need about three times... You know, you can buy about three times a house with whatever salary, right? I mean,
we talk about this every Monday with Nancy. This is dropping people's ability to pay for.
But this means just to pay the taxes, you need $70,000 a year of income.
Yeah,
and you have it. And by the way, that's 100% expense. You get zero of that back as equity.
You know what? On Friday, let's talk about if you get some of that back on your other taxes. I don't know if that's part of this. The stuff expiring in 2026, but hey, we got a dashboard. We'll talk on Friday. But I think we'll have a couple of things to talk about. What do you think?
We might have.
By the way, we missed this whole thing
about.
In here. I'll talk about it with Joel. Hang Seng's down almost 10% this morning because the huge bump up in the Chinese market sort of didn't happen after they were closed.
Yeah, there's you know, be careful with that, because if you remember in 2007, that was the early warning that we were about to get smocked.
Well, they just went up this much, so.
I know.
I mean, I got to believe just them pouring money in the system, that's not going to be a long term.
It doesn't work over the long term.
You
but
can't
it,
print
it,
value, as they say.
That's right. You can't print chickens.
Right. All right. Take care, bud. Let's do real quick here, Ricky, because we got to get to Joel. Or do you want to go to Joel right away?
Let's take a little break, and then we'll go back
take
to
a little
Joel.
Break. All right. SP futures up 24, NASDAQ futures up 101. About not quite half what we were down yesterday. We're trying to get back here. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now. Hello and
welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. S&P futures are up 25. NASDAQ futures are up 104. Like I said a minute ago, it's about half of what we were down yesterday. Dow futures up 50. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 34.2%. FTSE down 87. That's a full 1%. CAC around down 42. That's 0.6%. So Europe is the other way. They retreat because of the Asia situation, but we are not so far. UK is down 395. That's a full 1%. Hang Seng down 2,100. And I can't imagine what it was like to trade over there today. It's 9.4%. Now, they've been up a bunch, but still, that's a massive move in a day. Shanghai, which everybody thought was going to be absolutely to the moon because they've been closed. All these other guys have been rallying up. They were up 153, 4.5%, but that's a big disappointment. Everybody thought they'd be up like 15, and they aren't. Again, they've been a problem lately. Yesterday, Dow was down 398, S&P down 55, NASDAQ down 213. Oil is down $1.44, 75.70. Brent down 145, 79.48. Natural gas unchanged, 275. RBOB down 3 cents to 11. Got some people that are looking to chase this natural gas. Boy, I don't know. It was a great buy under two. I don't know where it's a buy here, 275, but time will tell on that. Gold up 280, 26.68. Silver down 38 cents, 31.61. Copper down 11 cents. That's a big move. 445. It's probably because of the Chinese markets. Chinese looking bad. They're a big user of copper. It's 2.5% on the copper. The euro is still under 110, 109.8. The British pound is 130, so the dollar is down a little bit today, but still it was on a seven-week high yesterday. We've got Bitcoin down 755, 62,539. Ricky, we got for us traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 6:36 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 46 degrees right now with a high of 72. Pleasant with plenty of sun. And tonight will be clear with a low of 55 degrees. On Phoenix, Arizona, 80 degrees right now with a high of 107. Partly sunny and very hot, so try to stay hydrated. Tonight will be partly cloudy and warm with a low of 76 degrees. Now for the traffic, actually the website that I was looking at doesn't work right now, so I'm going to have to get back to you next time. But we can go straight to the sports. Yesterday, the Tigers beat the Guardians 3-0, and the Royals beat the Yankees 4-2, and today we got a couple more games. Phillies playing the Mets at 4:08 p.m., and the Dodgers playing the Padres at 8:08 p.m. Lastly, the NFL last week, the Bears beat the Panthers 36-10, and the Cardinals beat the 49ers 24-23, pretty close match. This Thursday, October 10th, the 49ers play the Seahawks at 7:15, and this Sunday, the Bears are going to London. Bears play the Jaguars at 8:30 a.m. over in London, and the Cardinals play the Packers at 12 p.m. Lastly, the hockey season is back, and it seems like this Tuesday, today, we got the Blackhawks playing the Utah Hockey Club at 9 p.m. That's all I got for you, Chief.
But they got a new channel that nobody can get.
Really?
Yeah. Kind of bizarre. We have Joel?
Yes, we do.
Joel, how are you, buddy?
Good, Chief. How you doing on this this Tuesday?
Well, we have every series is 1-1 in the baseball.
Yeah, but the most important one is 1-1 after just an absolutely thrilling game yesterday.
I saw that.
I mean, those Motor City Kitties, man, they are igniting the Motor City. It's just so fun to watch. And then I don't know if I mentioned this last week. Do you know that they don't have a player over 28 years of age? And they don't have a player that makes more than $3 million?
I was going to mention that five of the teams in the playoffs... I don't know what the total is. 5 of 11, 12 in the playoffs. 12. are in the bottom nine of the league salaries.
Yeah, you have to wonder though. I mean, with what the Tigers are doing, I mean, I don't even know if they announced their starter for Wednesday yet. AJ Hinch, probably giving you guys all the information here, but he was down to two of his original five starters, and he's just started, you know, mixing and matching and bringing guys up. They actually had a guy pitch in the second game of the series against Houston. It was his third appearance in the major leagues, Jackson Job. So can you do that? Is it sustainable? Is it sustainable for a late playoff, late season run in playoffs?
Well,
maybe.
You're not one of those guys that says you should never have sex till you had it before. I mean, at some point, you got to get out there and pitch.
Exactly. No, it's fun. The Lions are look as good as well. Don't know what the Pistons or Red Wings have in store for us. Your Bears, Caleb Williams, put on a nice game. I still think a lot of Chicago fans are lamenting not drafting Jaden Daniels. I mean, how can you not? A potential Rookie of the Year MVP. But only time will tell on that one.
Well, the interesting boy, you can't. The Guardians are horrible, and they gave the Bears the team. I mean, look, the trade they made, then they don't even like the guy they drafted. Those guys are horrible. They're like Detroit when Matt Millen was running the place.
Yeah, you're referring to the Panthers, yeah.
Yeah.
You know who owns that team, correct?
Actually, I don't. Who does?
David Tepper.
Really?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, he needs a little work. What's with the Big Ten? Everybody's losing. Well, the football, college football is bizarre.
Yeah, Alabama goes down. My beloved Wolverines did not have a good game. We may have found a quarterback in the seventh-year player, Jack Tuttle. He's been everywhere. We were down 14-0, put him back in the game, and we came back and actually took the lead. But a couple costly turnovers. Alabama goes down. Texas looks good. Georgia has lost. I think what you're shaping, I think the in college football, we've been saying this for a long time, it's progressing more and more towards the professional end. Not only are players getting paid and the movement between teams, but now, like, one loss is not a death sentence. And I think there's going to be more than one or two teams with two losses that get in the playoffs with the top 12 teams. Now, Michigan already has its two losses, and it still has Oregon, Ohio State. But, yeah, that 12-team playoffs, it doesn't – that one loss is not as bad. That Alabama, what a shocker. The Vanderbilt students – they carried the goalpost all the way from the college campus, a couple miles off town, all the way down Broadway Street and took it. That's the heart of Nashville. So it's good to see the upsets, unless it's your team.
When I was at the University of Chicago, they had this crummy little team because they were in the Big Ten originally. Most people don't know that, but they bailed on big football. So they had this crummy little team. In my first year in grad school, they scored a touchdown in the first quarter of the first game and the last quarter of the last game. That was it. For the whole season, them in the end zone. So the next year, they're a little bit better. All of a sudden, they get it. The University of Chicago guys are so bizarre. All of a sudden, one week, they get close, and they got jabbed by the refs. How the hell do you get jabbed by the refs? So the next week, they win. They take down the goalposts, which had to be 100 years old. They were still the ones with the two, the two posts. They take the thing down and carry it down and throw it in Lake Michigan.
You're kidding me.
No. So next week, the offense, they didn't have any replacement goalposts. So next week, whoever was on offense had to turn around and face the one direction. The little field they had. Just saying.
You bring in University of Chicago in here. I have a little bit of Michigan trivia for you involving the University of Chicago.
Okay.
So, our fight song, Hail the Victors, right?
Hail the
Victor. You guys don't want me singing.
No, but that's a great fight song.
Okay, well, that was written by a University of Michigan student, Louis Elbel, in 1898, following a 12-11 victory over the University of Chicago that clinched the Western Conference Championships on Thanksgiving Day at Chicago Stagg Field. How's that for some worthless trivia?
Which is now a library. Stagg Field.
What library is it?
It's the University of Chicago Library.
Oh, you're kidding.
They're the only place
me.
In the world to turn on a football field for a library. And that's underneath that field is where the first sustained reaction happened for when they were making the bomb.
Were you... I thought you went to Notre Dame. Did you get your doctorate at University of Chicago?
Yeah, my MBA.
Wow, you're a smart guy.
Well, I don't know about that, but
how'd you end up on the floor after getting your MBA?
I had I had worked for Elliott Van Lines, then I worked for Pullman for a while, and Pullman decided they weren't going to build any more rail car contracts, and they essentially were going to lay everybody off because there wasn't going to be any stuff. So they sent me downtown to be saved, and the whole company got bought. So me being saved, everybody downtown got canned. And then they ended up hiring me back at the passenger unit because they had this big legal claim. So I wrote stuff for they hired me back like 2 months later for three times what I was making, right? And I figured, this isn't going to work out. So I always was trading because I loved options even when I was at the University of Chicago. So came down here, I would leave at noon, come down and take a bunch of courses and options, and all of a sudden one day I got myself a badge, and the second time I saw the floor, I was on it.
Oh, man, wow, getting a badge right away, that's a rare.
Well, it was one of those little tiny badges, the brown badge, you know, and I was sitting there going, I had a real job, and now I'm sitting here waiting for somebody to come by with an order. I'm like, this is crazy. But
it's a good story.
Ended up liking it, but I would have been very happy to stay at Pullman and still be making railroad cars. I loved it.
Okay. All right, real quick, China trade coming unraveled.
Yeah, what do you make of that?
I mean, it's just, you know, what goes up must come down, Chief. That was a big old move here. Now they want, you know, more stimulus from Xi. You know, they popped it up before Golden Week. I mean, this is, you know, this will be a test, you know. You have a big move after a long consolidation period. How much of this mood do they get back, and can they form another base to rally from? So,
how much of their – I mean, I will probably ask Russell tomorrow, but – we can pull this crap off over a long period of time, pour more money in the system. The Euro people probably can too if they're coordinated with us. How does China just keep jumping money into the system without their currency just going down?
That's what the concerns were by just more than you, Chief. So we'll see. I mean, and also just real quick before I go, what you had were in that big move in the Chinese stocks, you had a little bit of an unwind, and the unwind was coming out of tech, coming out of the big high price tech right into China. And now, since you're seeing that China trade come off here, tech is right back. Nvidia had a great day yesterday. The chips are back. So a lot of rotation. We'll just see if that continues, if they take some money off the table, some of these chip stocks, and go to China. But tech is what led us here, and hard to go against it. Even though you see these outside moves in China, you can see what could happen overnight while you're sleeping. Profits go poof. And the hurricane, just lastly, hurricane trade still going strong. Unfortunately, Generac up nearly up to 175 today.
Yep.
Hopefully, it won't be as bad as what they predict.
Well, it's down to a category 4, so that's a little better. Still not so high.
Yeah. All right, bud. So be careful. If they downgrade anymore, those profits of those stocks is going to be gone in the wind.
That's probably true. Ricky, do we have Kenny?
Go Blue!
I don't see Kenny yet, but we still have Carl. If he's
all right, minute we get Kenny, we'll if he calls in like last week, let's
absolutely. I'll let you know.
So, Carl, you're back, bud. Good for you. Where are you?
Well, I'm still here.
Well, there you go. You wonder. I've been in this business a long time, and I always stand by the idea that because of the way the margin works, If the market goes from 400 to 900, goes back to 400, you're net down. People lose more on the way down than they made on the way up, because generally there's more leverage once you get to the top.
Right.
I mean, a 9.4% move is one of the biggest moves we've ever seen in a market here. Now, obviously, those guys are a little more volatile, but how many people bought on margin to pay $23,000 for the Hang Seng yesterday, and now it's down to 21,000, and what the hell? I mean, are we talking forced sales already? I mean, I don't know. I don't know.
Well, that's how this kind of snowball gets going. All right. I mean, that's, you know, if you take a pebble and you push it off the top of a snow filled mountain, it could be a snowball the size of your house by the time it gets halfway down. And that's the problem with adding leverage into the system, which is what all the money printing really is when you get down to it. because the difference between money and credit is money is surplus from economic activity and credit is a promise to produce tomorrow. They spend exactly the same way. But when you do this, what you're basically doing as a government or as any other entity, or if you're a trader and you're putting on leverage, you're betting that on the come, the economic expansion that will follow will be enough to cover what you've done. I mean, that's the bet.
Well, absolutely.
And I mean, you know, that's what you believe is going to happen. If you don't believe that that's going to happen, then you're an idiot putting the leverage on. So the problem with this is there is a limit to how far this kind of crazy stuff can go. And yet when you look at the expansion that continues to go on, you know, China is full of this kind of stuff, especially in their property market. And yet they are building stuff that they don't have. People don't understand the scale of this. China has a huge population, but they're building more stuff than they have people.
Well, they must have stopped some of that building.
Well, so yeah, but the structure in what they put up is still there, all right? But it's not generating economic output.
They're open for a hurricane and knock it down so they can build it again.
Well, you know, I suppose that's one way to go at it. I just look at stuff like this and I'm like, okay, it always goes on for much longer and much more insane than you think it possibly can. Right? Every one of these cycles, that's the way it is. And if anything, it's gotten more crazy since the 2000 blow up. Right? Every time we've done this, you know, the 2000 tech wreck was, when you really get down to it, it was centered in a few little places within, you know, within the technology sector. And yet, a lot of the fear mongering that drove it was the whole Y2K thing. But there was
legitimate fear there.
There was legitimate fear that there was going to be a problem, all centered in the older systems that use COBOL and stuff like that. Okay, and you know, I mean, I've been an IT guy my entire professional life, so I mean, this is, you know, none of this is new. I saw all of it real time, and I poo-pooed a lot of it at the time. I said, "There's risk here, but it's nowhere near Apocalypse Now kind of stuff that everybody is, you know, is talking about." And of course, it turned out not to be. But the problem, Chief, is that on the back of that, you had all of these IPOs that came out that were claiming the GDP of the world times 10.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, obviously that wasn't going to happen. All right. And so, you know, but now you've got the same kind of thing going on. All right. We're going to save the world by everything being green energy. And by the way, that's a $20 trillion expense to, you know, to do that. But the payback is we have cleaner air, we have cleaner water, we're not going to, you know, we're going to stop being pigs, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, nice idea, except the cost of doing this on an ongoing run rate basis is not just the capital expense. It doubles, literally, or more, the cost of electrical power. Well, guess what? Energy is an input into every single economic thing you do.
Well, without a doubt.
All right, so tell me how you're going to get a GDP expansion in the long term, not in the short term, from building the stuff, because you will get, I mean, you know, if I put up a windmill, I've that's GDP, right? I got to make the rebar, I got to make the concrete, I got to make, you know, da, 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 da. Okay, fine. However, now the power is not 11 cents a kilowatt hour like it is here. It's 40 like it is in California because of these mandates and the fact that this renewable generation is unreliable. So I have to have a backup that is reliable. Otherwise, the lights don't work when I want them to. That doubles the cost or more. And now, after I get done building the windmills, I have put a permanent cost escalation into producing every single thing that the economy has.
Well,
tell me, Chief, how that's going to work out.
If you did it intelligently, that wouldn't be the way it worked.
Well, yes, it would, because that's just the reality. I get it that, you know, there's places like in the desert Southwest where, you know, not even a cockroach survives, right? And so you could put all the solar panels you want out there, whatever have you. But electrical energy is the highest form of energy that there that we currently have. All right, burning something is a lower form of energy. Every transformation costs you something. If you use a higher form of energy than you need for a particular process, that is essentially a tax when you get down to it. If you do that by mandate, nobody will do it voluntarily.
Well, you got to be careful that you don't. I mean, if you went back to the dirtiest coal without any sort of filter on it at all, which we probably wouldn't do these days, there's something called an economic externality.
Your
energy will be,
absolutely,
will
and
be
I'm
cheap.
Not just, yeah. and I'm talking about taking the total cost, at, you know, including the externalities. But you have to realize that some of these alleged externalities are inventions of crazy people's minds.
Oh, without a doubt. When we talk about the specific definition of what we're talking about is if the simple explanation was a paper I read many, many years ago, was if a plant goes into an area in Britain, and when I talk about people having lung cancer and all the other stuff that probably came from it, but if everybody had a whitewash before they had paint, their house every 5 years, and because of the dirt the place put out, everybody had to do it every 3 years, that's a cost that's not borne by the plant, it's borne by external people. It's
right.
Called an economic externality, and you see that a lot. In other words, if somebody, you know, puts some kind of whatever place near your house, and all of a sudden your car gets the rain your car gets on, it means you got to wash your car or wax it every 3 weeks instead of every 6 months. That's a cost you have to bear that they don't.
Right, and they shoved that off on you. Right, and these things are real, and they're real problems. Okay, and I'm not trying to minimize them in any way because they are real. But what the invented externalities that a lot of people scream about, the whole, you know, we're all going to broil to death, is just pure nonsense. And the bigger issue with that is that if your bet on these technologies is that it's going to improve economic efficiency and therefore economic output, when you impose these permanent costs, that is not going to, the outcome that you claim is going to be there is not going to happen.
Well, without a doubt.
And that's the problem with all of this, is that when you get to the end of the road on this kind of thing, you want to know what's driven the offshoring to a significant degree. All right, now, unless you're going to throw tariffs on things and force that back into the United States, and for some of it, I argue
we're just offshoring child labor and pollution is all we're doing.
Well, and we should ban that, and the way you ban it is through wage and environmental parity tariffs. All right.
Hey, I want to shift gears for a second. I want your opinion. I won't wait till Friday. I've been doing some work on correlations between some of the stuff I did, and I say the stuff I did in 2000. I was still trading, but I was doing more lecturing, and the crash happened, you know, with the Ciscos and all those things going back to zero damn near, and some of the research I did afterward was like, yeah, these stocks are like way higher than any stocks they've ever seen in terms of, you know, 10, 11, 12 times earnings, or not earnings, revenue, and they just got really, really high, and at the same time, the invention, which I thought and still do, because I still have a lot of my clients, well, most of my clients, and a lot, and some of them, the ETFs, the way to get diversified, way to buy the market, and using options, you can then maneuver your risk curve to whatever you want it to be, you know, and that's what I do for people, or what my firm does for people.
Right.
But I never kind of put two and two together, Carl, that maybe one of the reasons why those stocks got so expensive is because the people buying the stocks didn't even know they were buying them. They were, at the time, Cisco, Oracle, and the other three was it Dell, Microsoft, and what was the other one? Intel. They were 48, 49% of the QQQs, which had just come out
right.
As an ETF. So people were pouring money into QQQs because it was moving. And it was moving because people were pouring money into QQQs, right? I mean, it was a circular game. And when they all crashed, and I was doing some lectures to people that they had those stocks, and they were all sniveling about it, and I said, well, you know, I never even heard of an individual stock trading for those multiples. And I've heard stuff trading for 200 PE if you think the thing's going to grow. And earnings don't mean crap in terms of a growth stock, right? It's how fast they're growing, and they should right. They should mean something pretty soon, but they have to mean something that year. But revenue times, you know, time per share is a lot, because it's really double. It's really hard for a big company to like double revenue. You can double earnings easy enough, or not easy enough, but within reason. But doubling revenue is a real problem, right? I mean, it's a big deal, especially for a stock that is that big, which Cisco was. Now I look at today's group of five or six or seven, whichever you manage, and I look at the numbers. And this isn't investment advice. This isn't anything, because I have a lot of people that own all this stuff, and we try and protect it for them and in case something bad happens, or when something bad happens, or whichever adjective you want to use, adverb. But I wonder if it's the same phenomenon. There's people that if they send me some money, which they do all the time, and say, "Chief, you know, I like to be in one of these ETFs and blah, 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 and protect it. Well, I'd like the QQQ. It's the one that's moving." So I dutifully put, you know, $500,000 of QQQ, and I'll buy some puts, maybe sell some calls they want me to, whatever is tailored to the individual. So I'm not as worried about it because I have the puts protection all the time. But the same token, I'm doing the same thing people did in 2000. I mean, they're buying these stocks. They have no idea, and actually most money managers don't either. Now, right. I just listened to guys on CNBC this morning and last night because they want to, you know, keep track of the hurricane and everything. I actually have the sound up. And every guy is taking what he said. They actually act like, you know, the prices of Microsoft and NVIDIA are legit. I mean, it's like, right. I mean, you know, when I say legit, they're trading there, okay? And don't short them because you're going to get stuck where the sun don't shine. But the fact is, a company that large with those kind of numbers is unheard of. I mean, I'm not saying it's not legit, but I just challenge anybody to tell me how Microsoft's going to double anytime soon. I mean, it's just, maybe it will, or maybe it'll raise all their prices. I don't know. Maybe that's the game. But whatever it is, I think when people are buying stuff, I love these ETFs, but I think there's a downside to them.
Yeah, yeah, and I would agree with that, is that's absolutely the case. And that's one of the things that I just kind of look at and go, what in the...
yeah.
Right? And I think that's what we're headed for, is some real trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, unless we grow into it, which is possible, and I don't mean... No, throw more money at stuff.
Look, Chief, not when you put a 100% escalation or more into the cost of energy inputs.
Well, that's a problem. And then you
see, and that's what we're doing, and we need to stop it, because eventually, and it won't be very long either, we keep that up, that is gonna come directly out of margins, and you know what happens when you crunch margins in the equity markets.
Well, we talk about insurance bills, and we talk about taxes, and we are pretty silent on utility bills, but there's a creep there just as bad.
Yeah, and it's bad.
We'll talk at you Friday, bud. SP Futures up 25, NASDAQ Futures up 107. Want to go right to hell? You want a quick break, Ricky?
Whatever you want, man.
Yeah, let's go right to the professor. He's listening in. He maybe has a comment. The professor.
Hey, what's up, Tom?
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
How's that? Yeah. How's that house in Florida doing?
In Florida?
Yeah, I thought you got one down there, a couple.
Nah. I had a buddy who had a second row house in Amelia Island. And every time I went down to visit him, this is before I got married, he was like looking forward to the hurricane coming because he was hoping it would wipe out the front row homes. Because if a row of homes is wiped out in Florida, apparently you can't rebuild them, and he would have a front row.
You know what he sounds like?
He sounds like the guys in Superman where they're trying to cause the earthquake with the nuclear.
Yeah, Lex Luthor. For anybody who didn't watch Superman, it was a great movie. He was trying to put a bunch of A-bombs in the San Andreas Fault.
Yeah.
With the idea that California would slip into the sea. And he had bought all the property in Nevada, which would now become beachfront property or something.
It's kind of like Blazing Saddles on steroids, right?
So Superman had to decide whether he was going to save the world by fixing the fault, or whether he was going to save Lois Lane, who was in an avalanche of some kind.
Well, he did both,
but he wasn't supposed to do the second one, but he did. Ricky, well, you know, Ricky, Ricky, how do you, how do you do the second one, which you never was supposed to do?
Yeah, even when I was a kid, when he spun the earth backwards to go back in time, I mean, how I still don't understand how he was able to do that. I mean, he did that to save Lois Lane, but wouldn't he have just spun the earth back in time and the San Andreas fault falls anyway?
Well, yeah, but he'd got the bombs out of there.
Well, but when he spins the earth back in time, right, we reset to the earlier point.
That's why they call it a movie.
But even as a kid, I was like, I didn't buy it. You know, it was a good movie, but I didn't buy it back then when I was a kid.
Well, Lois Lane was pretty hot. It was worth it.
I never, maybe when Margot Kidder was younger, when I was a kid, she kind of reminded me of like a mom. I mean, I never thought she was very attractive at all.
She's a mom I liked, you know. I'm not in for the movie star type.
She might have been okay when she was younger, you know.
She wasn't old when she did the movie. Were you talking about like when she was 18 or what?
She was probably 30, wasn't she?
Well, that's not all that old.
Well, but I was like 14, 15, all right. Maybe even 12 when that came out.
Just
yeah.
Remember,
I might have been 12 when that came out.
Cal, as you go through life, anybody 10 years older than you, regardless of what your age, is old.
Yeah, well, when you're in high school, you know, when you're in high school and you got a teacher who's 22 and she coaches the volleyball team, Mrs. Rude, she seems old.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
She's only 22. She was barely out of high school.
God.
When you're you know, 15, 16 years old and you're a freshman in high school, it's like, forget 50. Forget 40. I mean, those guys are way past.
Oh, yeah, they're way past. But the I always thought the girls in their 20s were hot even when I was 16. I was never a girl.
Well, you know, that's the funny thing about being 16. I mean, that is pretty much the case, right?
God. Anyway, what do you make of this Chinese mess this morning? Everybody thought this. Yesterday I was talking on the show about how Shanghai, as the Nikkei and the Hang Seng have gone straight up, incredibly straight up for really more almost 2 weeks, and mainland China has been closed. I thought they'd be like up 15% today, and they're evidently the up 4% totally disappointed everybody. So the Hang Seng comes back 9.5%. Nikkei's only back 1%, but still, it's a move back. But Hang Seng, ouch. 9.5%.
Well, I think it's a great example of groupthink. I mean, in China, you're not allowed to think outside of the CCP's official narrative, right? So you're not allowed to. And if you do, then your travel's restricted. So my brother-in-law, Chris, traveled extensively in China a couple years ago in his college matriculation. I mean, he's like me. He was in college forever. He finally graduated. But he went to China for like a whole summer, and he got to know the culture pretty well. They have their, you know, the public opinions, and then they have their close to the vest opinions. And it's like a long tradition in China that you have both. You have your external views and you have your internal views, and you only let the state know your external views. But with its surveillance, it's becoming very difficult to keep your closely held views, you know, out of government's hands. And so in China, you have this real extreme groupthink, and they've just bought into this nonsense, this Keynesian nonsense that, you know, this, we can print money, we can run debt, print money, and there's no debate, right? So they're just all in on this nonsense. They're printing money. They're like Carl was saying, they're building, they built more homes than they need in the entire country. I mean, they're just going all in. In the United States, we have pushback, we have debate. During the housing bubble, we had these empty skyscrapers in San Diego and Miami that nobody lived in. They have whole cities that nobody's living in, right? So they're all in on this nonsense, right? And that's why I've never really worried about China. Because what China tends to do, just like Mao did, Mao's Marxism kind of locked in the state of knowledge at that time. It locked it in for like 20, 30 years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And dictators do this. Dictators, they fear being toppled, right? They live in a constant state of fear. You know, Putin has people testing his food, right? They're going to die before he dies. So these tyrants live in a constant state of fear because there are a bunch of people that want his job, their job, right? So they live in a constant state of fear. And this is an old, well-known narrative, going back to the pharaohs of Egypt, right? I mean, how did Joseph rise to power? Because the pharaoh lived in a constant state of fear. Joseph was able to interpret the king's dreams. And of course, Joseph's going to tell him what he wants to hear because he wants to get out of jail, man. He's stuck in jail. So Joseph takes over the economy for Pharaoh. And what does he do? He slaps on a huge tax in an economy that is mostly agricultural, 86% agricultural. And so they start taxing all this agriculture. And the great, you know, 7 years later, they got all this government storage of grain. But when you tax that economy as much as they did, think about how much is left over for the individual farmers to eat. They gotta save some of their harvest for next year. They're probably at subsistence levels. And so this taxing year after year after year, of course the economy is going to shrink, and that taxing.
But hell, is any economy, you know, if I was back in school, I did a two quarter course on the history of economic thought, and it was one of the most informative.
Oh, those are the best economics courses in my opinion.
Because
yeah.
I mean, I wonder if I still have my notes somewhere. Russell's always asked me to dig through my place and find them, but. How every country makes it from the Industrial Revolution from this area to that area, and how the numbers go along the way, and how you all of a sudden start counting stuff you didn't count, so you think you're growing but you're really not. You
know, yeah, you're just counting new stuff.
Just counting new stuff, and we had a gentleman on again he used to work with PTI for a while that did all this grain stuff with China, and they had this is before COVID, so there was big cooperation between the Department of Agriculture in the U.S. and the Department of Agriculture in China. I mean, people trying to get, because they're buying a lot of soybeans from us and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, it's marketing, basically. But we'd have groups here for 10 days. I mean, groups, there'd be like 7 to 10 people from China would come over. And, you know, this guy would entertain them, you know, here in our office and other places. And we never got paid for it. They did, by the Department of Agriculture. But I would go with on some of these little junkets. When I say junkets, we went to a ethanol plant, which is pretty cool. We went on a barge trip on the Illinois River, which was really cool. I'd never been in a 200 foot deep lock, and I'm sitting there going, boy, this thing better work. it's a long way to the top if you had to swim up there. I don't think I'll make it. 200 feet, I don't think you make it up, do you, without a tank. But, you know, you glean stuff that back in the day, however many years ago this was, the size of a family farm in China was like an eighth of an acre.
Yeah.
Enough for chickens, a couple of cows, and maybe you grew enough to feed the chickens.
Yeah, you grew barely enough to live on, right?
Yeah. And so the massive movement of those people to the cities.
Yeah.
I mean, in 1900, I'm talking off the top of my head here, but 1900, I think Chicago was, I think, topped out at 3 million people or something. And I believe it was one of the 10 biggest cities in the world, something like that, or 15 biggest. And within like 20 years during the 80s, 90s, you know, whatever, China ended up with what? How many cities over 5 or 6 million? And all these people just moved from the agrarian areas, just poured into these cities.
Yeah.
So, I guess, you know, they foolishly kept it, thought it was going to keep coming, and built all these cities in anticipation of, and people never showed up.
It's not that they expanded current cities. They built new cities that nobody actually lives in.
Well, right, but I'm saying there's cities in China with 4 and 5 million people. Mayor Daley's telling us when we'd be in the club together. They had cities there, 4 or 5 million people that, you know, 50 years ago were like 500,000. I mean, it's incredible the amount of people that came in from the rural, you know, the rural areas, which we did in this country too, but nothing to that extent.
Well, you know, Hong Kong had something happen to it too before it was taken over by China. If you look at like the neighborhoods in Hong Kong, we're talking about density upon density that you cannot imagine. And then just think about why that is. It was so bad in China that people would come in from China, migrate to Hong Kong, and then pile into that very, very small country. And those buildings are just dense. I mean, you think New York City's dense. I mean, the density in Hong Kong is just beyond words. And that's how bad it is in China, right? And going back to the Joseph thing, you know, Joseph was taxing. He monopolized basically agriculture. And in the seventh year of his program, what happened? He had a monopoly on grain, and it spread throughout the Middle East. People from Israel coming into Egypt because they heard that Egypt's got grain. They're selling it not for free. They're not giving it away for free. Joseph is selling it at a monopoly price. So the Pharaoh's fears is what led to the policy that created the famine, in my opinion. And that's what these dictators do. History tends to repeat, and repeated history repeats repeatedly. The more you know history and understand it, and instead of learning historical dates, learn the context, and it's just rich with examples. And I think what happens is these guys, they know just enough economics. They know that if they do X, Y, and Z, they can monopolize a country, you know, through these populist promises. Then the central bank's got to step in and print money.
It's the business of politics. I mean, I say this every other day. If you were to take one of the most frustrating things I learned or tried to learn in Chicago in this one class was how to design executive compensation packages for the long run of the shareholders, the company, and the community, because they're all the same. I mean, you can't, and the employees. I mean, you can't have a 100-year plan where your employees are pissed off for 100 years.
No, you can't. Now, I mean, you're going to end up with a union.
You can end, well, but even then, you can end up with you could probably pull it off for 3 years or 5 or 10, depending on your area. And oh, by the way, if the city you're in absolutely hates you, that's a problem. to devise an executive compensation package for the long run good of everybody, including the chief executive, is a real problem. And try and do it. We were doing it every class. He'd say, here's this guy, here's this company, go home and design a package. He'd come back and he'd pick on somebody and he'd go, hey, Hal, what's yours? And you go, well, I have this kind of bonus. The whole class would go, nah. Basically participate and say what a horse bleep idea yours was. And everybody, the whole class is at you. But it's really hard to do. But take for instance, if you were to try to do that, or if I could design, which I can't, the perfect compensation package that everybody agreed with, drop that on the Constitution and how many years people are in office and how often they have to run, it'd be nothing like that, right?
Yeah.
So when you have, I mean, look at the motivations. If when you talk about money supply and putting money in the system, or like Al says, you put credit in the system. If I'm Caesar and I control everything and I've got a printing press in the back, and a guy like Ricky comes in and he goes, man, I bought this house, and all of a sudden a hurricane comes by. He's like, I got no house. And you go, God, I like Ricky, and blah, blah, blah. His wife looks nice, and the little bambino's cool. It's real easy for me to go in a back room and run off about 30 grand and say, here, will this help? And Ricky walks out, and now he can go rent a place for a while until he gets back on his feet. It is so easy to do that, okay?
And if
you have an economy the size of ours, you go, I know if I keep doing this for everybody, one of these days the price is going to be up 2% across the board, and I'm the one who did it. But do I really give a crap if I'm only in office for 2 years and I've got a 10 years before this hits home? Do I care?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you see in the last 40 days or 30 days of this. Trump and Harris will promise everybody everything.
They will, yeah.
Somewhere, I mean, we've got a guy who, one of the reasons why we are, and again, I'm absolutely, I don't want to pay another nickel in taxes. Everybody knows that. But we got a guy who put through a tax cut and said it was going to save the government money, which is total BS. And we had another guy who's been in office that said he's going to put all this money out there for infrastructure, half of which people steal along the way. And oh, by the way, there's going to be neighborhoods that don't do anything. They're now going to have 5G, and in 5 years, they'll be paying so much taxes, we'll be a surplus. And that's all BS, too. So, and now we got a guy saying he's going to cut taxes more. I mean, I feel like sending them more on a calculator. And then we've got a lady running on the other side saying she's going to pay $50,000 for a house or something along those lines. I haven't actually gone through the numbers, but she's going to give people. She realizes that poor people can't, or middle-class people can't afford a house anymore, and she's going to fix that by giving them money. Well, the fact is, we're broke. So somewhere along the line, somebody's going to have to look at those numbers and say, well, what exactly can we do and how are we going to do it? And it's not printing more money to flow over, to just cover over the problems we have. But I don't see, I mean, if he gets in, he's a lame duck. I mean, has there ever been a time, there probably has been, that I don't recall my history, the day the dude gets in there, if he gets in, he's a lame duck. Now, what does that even mean?
I don't know if he is a lame duck, because I think coming back from a loss has only happened one other time. And what was that, Grover Cleveland? And I don't think Grover Cleveland was necessarily a lame duck.
Well, I mean, depending on the House and depending on the Senate, and just say he wins both.
Yeah.
The last.
Well, I think it's also going to be interesting to see what his cabinet looks like and who the people he hires, because I don't think he's going to be hiring from the same pool that he hired from.
I agree, but what I'm saying is, even if he gets both houses of Congress, Obama had that for a while. It didn't do him any good because all his own people were fighting. Same thing happened to Bush. He had both houses, and all he did was fight.
Well, I think the problem with the back-to-back, you know, 8 years in a row kind of thing, is that in that second 4 year period, you have kind of the same people there. People like their compensation. I think the president knows that they're done in 4 years, and so they're probably watching friendly media. The people are telling them, you know, they're Mike Tysoning them, right? Telling them, hey, you're doing a great job. And I think these presidents don't really know how bad things are in that second term. And I think what happens is you have all these yes people in your corner.
They surround themselves. They don't hear from the outside. But my point is, government takes a long time, even if it's done properly. Yeah. So if Trump comes in, or whatever, even Kamala could be a one-term president as well. If somebody comes in and all of a sudden the Congress is, they have two or three major plans, they start year one. Well, if both of them don't get anywhere, now it's year two. Then all of a sudden it's year three, and everybody's worried about who's running next.
Then it's an election year.
Yeah. Then it's an election year. I mean, it's in 4 years is a long time for people as they get older, but it's not for government. And you can make somebody a lame duck immediately. And
I think our system of government is flawed in the sense that it creates this hyper focus on the short run. Think about the House of Representatives.
Exactly what I was saying about executive compensation. It makes
So they have a year to prove to their voters that they can bring home the bacon, right? And so that's what they do, right? And then they can tout it the very next year.
Well, if you wanted to, we have stuff that I believe, and I think there's a lot of agreement on the show, maybe among the listeners, we have stuff that absolutely needs to be taken apart and done differently. Our medical system, for sure. And I'm not talking about, you know, socialized medicine. I'm saying the cost structure, the monopolization in that system is dramatic.
Yeah, it's beyond
dramatic. And now,
it's beyond the monopoly.
But that's not a 4 year project.
Yeah,
that's an 8 year project at best. I mean, I've a couple friends of mine were just in the hospital last couple of weeks. They're in there 5-6 days, and there's like no care, just test after test after test. And we're talking about. Yeah. You know, I'm going to say it's upwards.
Well, why is that? Because every little test has a big Medicare code, right?
Well, and
you got to harvest. You got to harvest all that. You got to mine all those.
Well,
codes.
But everybody talks about Medicare. Medicare pays way less than other insurance.
But so, you got to mine those codes, Tom. That's the secret.
Well, I understand
you got to mine those codes.
What,
right?
What I'm saying is, I'll bet the gross number is going to be $225, and Medicare will pay $90 or something like that.
Yeah, but that's the key point, right?
Yeah.
You have these price controls on all these services according to Medicaid and Medicare. And so the way you extract the money from the insurance company, if you're the provider, is you mine the codes. You find all these little codes, you fill up the patient's, you know, sheets with these codes, and then instead of just getting what they need, which is price controlled, you do all this other stuff that probably isn't needed, so you can mine the code to maximize the amount that you can extract from Medicaid or Medicare.
Well, I'm no issue with that, but my point is, we cannot be sitting as a society 30 years from now where a few companies make stuff for $5 and sell it for $1,000.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't have people having chemotherapy treatments that are $20,000 a pop when in reality, now if the thing actually costs that, well then yeah, but if it's $100 a pop, I don't see how we do that. And you know, and we have drug companies, I mean, we somehow or another we're going to have to, now I think it has to change with the patent laws, it has to change everywhere. This is not the drug companies that whoever gets in, if they're in for only 4 years, breathe a huge sigh of relief because you can't go near them. What if you try and sue them? They won't even be heard for 4 years.
Yeah.
I mean, they time is on the side of the big people. And you know,
the interested parties in healthcare, they got lots of power and they have this claim to be experts, right? So we have to bow down. We have to bend our knee to their expertise, right?
And everything is research. You got to give me $90 bazillion for research. Okay, but you're not doing the research. You're buying other people that are doing the research. You know, to some extent. I mean, I'm not sure we can possibly ever get the will to change some of these things.
I think the power is, you know, the people that are making these agreements. Like for example, I mean, we have monopsony examples everywhere that government allows. Well, I mean, think about the draft. Think about professional sports, right? You have the veterans have a monopsony, and they are trying to take all the owner surplus. The owners agree to that because the owners in the draft have a monopoly on the hiring of rookies. So the rookies who have no power, no voice, probably nobody informing them what's going on. They really have no power, and they're going from a place where, you know, they used to be compensated with just tuition and books and room and board, and they're getting drafted and they're getting paid $8 million a year. Well, that sounds great, right? Until they become a veteran, they realize, whoa, man, we can steal the owner surplus, right? So the government allows the veterans to form this monopsony.
I'm gonna disagree with you. I'm gonna disagree with you the same way I do it with Lou. There's no way, despite the fact that there's a quote union, and people, I shouldn't say this, but I will. People think that because there's a union, there's a collective bargaining agreement, that things are even. You can't have a union against.
Oh, no, I'm not saying they're even.
There's no such thing as a union. If a union decides to start playing ball with a monopoly, all it does is help the monopoly.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, but the monopoly, the union is in basically representing the veterans, not the rookies.
Well, that's exactly right.
The rookies get bananas. They get.
But hey, look at your population. Yeah. If you and I were to have a couple of cocktails tomorrow night or whenever, we'll go to the series. Then we'll go to three other places. Then we'll just walk down Michigan Avenue.
Well, I won't have a cocktail because I can't handle. I do not like the taste of alcohol. I don't care if it's mixed with something. I cannot do.
I've seen you have a beer.
I love an oatmeal stout or a brown ale. I can't do Guinness stout. I just don't think it tastes very good.
You'd love my brother's stuff. He had his.
I love oatmeal stout. I like porters. I like
his best beer is a porter.
Yeah,
that he makes.
Yeah, I like that stuff, but I can only have one of them.
I will wager you in an adult beverage of your choice that if we interviewed, quick interview, 100 people, and asked them if there is free agency in baseball, it's called free agency. They would say free agency rules baseball.
Yeah.
And yet, does it? How many people, the entire chain of people that get signed for the whole minor league system, how many people have the chance to change teams when they feel like it? Out of, what, a couple of thousand? There's maybe 5 or 6 free agents every year, 10?
Yeah. Well, I'm saying, relatively speaking, right, compared to the rookies, rookies have no way to negotiate with anybody but the team that drafts them, right?
Okay, but I know you're talking about the economics part of this, and I'm trying to lure you toward the people part of this.
Yeah.
When you had rookies in professional football, I'll go back 10 years, and people were signing these rookie contracts, and people were calling to the show, giving me a bunch of crap about it, and which is fine. I mean, that's why we're here to disagree. Saying these rookies are killing these owners because quarterbacks were getting, you know, $30 million contracts, and that's when the new contract came in, and now they slot the rookies where every one of the, you know more about this than me. Every if you're drafted one or two or three or four, you're slotted, and you can only get a certain amount. So if you're the eighth pick, you can only get a certain amount less than the first pick and a little bit more than the tenth pick. I don't know how that works. Luke could probably tell us, but you're slotted, and every person who's a football fan, except for maybe me, said this was great. It protected the owner. And I'm sitting there. I'd be sitting with some guys going, wait a minute. A guy gets drafted. He can't go anywhere else. and he's sitting down with, like, the Bears, and he's putting one over on the Bears. Yeah, they've been screwing these owners. I'm going, are you an owner? Well, no. Why do you act like you're an owner? What makes you think that this guy has any advantage whatsoever over the Bears or the Cardinals or the Colts? What do you mean? Look at the money they're getting. It's not about the money. All it means is how much the other guys are making. But, you know, have that conversation now. Anybody who makes more than you is overpaid, correct?
Well, I don't think so.
You don't, but you're an intelligent man. Most people, anybody who makes more than you, something's wrong.
Yeah.
He's overpaid.
I don't buy that at all. With regard to the rookies' salaries, think what they would be if there was no draft, and they would be free to negotiate with any team, right? So there's two things going on here. There's that, and then the draft. The rookie salaries that we see and we go, wow, that's a lot of money. It's the Austrian business cycle theory. The money that is being printed, right? The people that get that money first are able to buy assets that haven't appreciated yet, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you have this thing where a contract was signed, and it was an incredible contract 5 years ago, and this guy's a quarterback, and he's at the top of his game, and he's making a lot of money. But what happened in those 5 years? You had all this money that was injected into the system that all of a sudden creates this inversion, right? So it wasn't for the Fed.
Well, why don't you hold this after break, because I got about three follow-up questions on that. Okay. SP Futures up 20, NASDAQ Futures up 74. Of course, if you were to take the my bartender buddy or my owner of the bar near me, if you give him all that money, he says, I spent 90% of it on women, booze, and fast cars, and the other 10% I wasted. We'll be right back. On that note, we'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons. New technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher. It may not. It could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains. Think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe thinking about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the Interactive Broker high-end platform. There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to access Dan Janitas at Kratos Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can, whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You'll have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at time@ptisecurities.com.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here. Right now. Right here, right now, right now.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Ricky on the board.
S&P futures up 21. NASDAQ is up 78. We're leaking down a little bit from where we were since we had a big down move yesterday. So we were half of it back. We're not quite half of it back yet. We have some interesting moves in the Asian markets. We've got oil down. We've got the XLE, which is the oil piece of the S&P. Which has been on a tear down a little bit today. Not huge, but down some. We still have the 10-year. This is going to bite the market in the ass one of these days if it keeps doing this. 10-year rate is up to 4.05 now, so it's going up every single day. It's absolutely on a tear. Where are we going to go here? Let's go to bonds first. Like I said, it's up 2 basis points, 4.05. The Bund up, well, it's unchanged, sort of, 2.25. Japan up another 0.94. The European markets, a little bit of a mixed bag here. They're all down, but different degrees. DAX is down 30 points. It's only 0.2%. FTSE down 95, however, it's 1.2%. CAC around down 50.7%. So they're all down, but this is the interesting one. China has reopened after, I think, 7 or 10 days are closed. They're up $153. It's 4.5%. Hang Seng, which has been up the entire time, is down 2,100 points. It's 9.4%. It's a massive down day. Nikkei down 395, 1%, sort of in the middle there. So, yeah, the enthusiasm that was grabbing this Hang Seng market while the mainland China markets were down, it's kind of getting paid back today. I said yesterday, Dow was down 398, S&P down 55, NASDAQ down 213. So we're back almost half of the S&P, maybe a third of the NASDAQ. So far, not a bounce like we were down yesterday. We've got gold is up $6, $26.72. Silver over down 32 cents, $31.67. I mean, pretty good volatility between the gold and the silver lately. Copper down 9 cents, 447, had a big move up yesterday. Foreign exchange, dollar's back a little bit. It's actually unchanged against the euro at 109.7. British pound unchanged at 130.9. But dollar's been strong in the last week or so. Bitcoin, Bitcoin's down 713, 62,580. A lot of stuff there. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:35 here in beautiful Chicago. 46 degrees right now with a high of 72. Pleasant with plenty of sun. And tonight is going to be clear with a low of 55 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 81 degrees with a high of 107. Partly sunny and very hot, so we want to make sure to stay hydrated. Tonight will be partly cloudy and warm with a low of 76 degrees. On the traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, 49 minutes. We're looking at 82 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lynn Cook. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 51 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 26 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 45 minutes. Lastly, sports. Yesterday, the Tigers beat the Guardians 3-0, and the Royals beat the Yankees 4-2. And today in the MLB, we have the Phillies playing the Mets at 4 p.m., and the Dodgers playing the Padres at 8 p.m. The NFL, last week, the Bears beat the Panthers 36-10, and the Cardinals beat the 49ers 22-23. Very close match. This Thursday, October 10th, 49ers play the Seahawks at 7:15, and this Sunday, the Bears are going to London to play the Jaguars at 8:30 a.m. Cardinals play the Packers at 12 p.m. on that day too, Sunday, October 10th. Lastly, hockey season is back. The Blackhawks play the Utah Hockey Club today at 9 p.m. Back over to you, Chief.
Kevin just texted in here about, as a counter to slotting, stadiums agents are starting to demand voidable years on the contracts. That's the fallback there. I don't know, what do you think of that, Al? Because there's a little bit of a pushback. Hey, by the way, when did unions, and I used to know something about unions, when did unions start giving wages for the new people less than the old people? They never did that when I was in the union. When did that become something they did?
When the professional sports teams unions?
When you were a teamster, I mean, you maybe made a little less than the guy who was older than you, but by and large, if you were the first day on the hauling freight on the truck docks, you made as much as the guys that were there. The guys were forklift drivers, maybe a little more or something, but they weren't making 30 an hour and you making 15, like some of the entry level stuff is now.
The only time I was in a union was when I was. It wasn't really that it was a union, but the Teamsters were trying to get into Guardian Glass in Michigan when I was in between my first and second dropouts of college, leaving the Navy, and then going back to college. I was working in Michigan for like 8 months, and we were being romanced by the Teamsters, and for a little while I was officially represented by them, but I'd never, well, I guess I was in the SEIU at Mercy University as a professor, but my salary really didn't go up. I was being paid $3,500 before as an adjunct at Mercy and for 3-credit course. And then I got the same pay after the union, but I had to pay like $40 a month while I was teaching for dues. So I probably actually lost on the deal. So those are my only two experiences with the union. And for the SEIU union at Mercy University, if you get hired to teach a class, I guess you're going to get paid the same amount as somebody that's been doing it for, you know, 20 years at Mercy. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose, I think in a market system, people where owners are free to hire whomever they want and employees are free to accept those offers or not, I think the first people hired would be paid a lot less than the experienced people, because you want to keep the experienced people. I mean, at McDonald's, you want that guy that's really good at taking orders. He can take a drive-in order and he can take a counter order at the same time. He can take the pickle off the Big Mac. You want to keep those guys around, and those guys are the guys that have been there for 3 or 4 years that you know, they're like in the Matrix. They don't see the code anymore. They see blonde, brunette, redhead. You want to keep those guys around. So of course you're gonna pay them more. In a union situation, I think you're right. I think the last hired is probably gonna get paid the same amount as the first hired, right?
Well, I mean, there was always what has happened. I think it happened with the auto workers. It certainly happened with the football players.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But it's the idea that we don't feel like paying you guys $35 an hour going forward. And the guys are saying, well, that's okay. Why don't you pay the guys for the first 5 years that aren't even here yet and don't have a seat at the table? Why don't you pay them 15 for a while and keep us at 35?
Well, yeah.
I think
in the NFL, the reason why there's such a salary inversion is because the young people that are hired, you know, if they fizzle out, they're gone. They're not going to get a new contract. But the ones that, you know, survive that first contract and then thrive in their second and third contract, I think the ones that are thriving in their second, third, and fourth contract are the exception. And so I think the veterans, I mean, I think the way the owners look at them is you got these veterans and their physical skills are depreciating quickly because of injury and wear and tear. I mean, just look at Earl Campbell. The dude played basically on asphalt, right, in the Astrodome.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, his physical abilities depreciated rapidly. I think after his third or fourth year, I mean, they were just gone in that fifth or sixth year. His knees were just gone, right? So I think that has something to do with it. I think they're making this calculation, this finance calculation, where they're calculating the net present value of, you know, the expected payout from this player versus this player. And these younger guys, they haven't had that deterioration, that depreciation in their physical capital.
Well, if they start playing, they start putting 100 people in the college playoffs and there's an extra 8 games, they're going to get the same deterioration in college.
Oh, I know, yeah. I mean, think about the Miami quarterback. I mean, sometimes I think, did he sign a contract and now he wants out? Because you would think a guy that loves football, that wants to be in, I don't know who he is. You know, maybe he likes football.
This isn't the guy with the concussions, Tua?
Yeah, but the last time he went, his last concussion was caused by him diving headfirst in the defensive player. I mean, if he was really passionate about football and he wanted to hang out for 10 years like Aaron Rodgers, 20 years, 30 years, he would be sliding into those tackles.
Well, some of those guys, that's the way they play. I mean,
But he was never at Alabama. He was never one where he was going to – he wasn't a Jalen Hurts, right? Jalen Hurts is squatting 600 pounds. He wasn't a Jalen Hurts type of player. He was always the guy who was going to throw it, right, down the field. But he's going head first. I mean, maybe he's just not very bright, or maybe he wants to cash out. I don't know what his motivation is.
But people sometimes – I mean, you would think. I mean, my cousin played way back in the day. He's way older than me. Played for halfback for Colorado. He went to Tilden Tech here in Chicago. That was when guys would carry the ball 25, 30 times a game. And he said, you know, you have to know the plays. If there's three guys waiting for you, you hit the ground and get as much as you can, or you get out of bounds or you do something. Because three or four times a game, if it's a first down or something, you're going to pile into those guys and try and knock them back. He goes, but you can't do that 20 times a game.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for a quarterback, when he's running, he might be running for a very key first down. So in his mind, you know, it's worth it to go basically balls out on that play. But, you know.
But Tua's not the kind of player. He's not the Jalen Hurts type of quarterback. He's just not. Right? I've never seen him play like that. He's not going to run over people like Jalen Hurts does. Jalen Hurts is a running back who can throw the football, right?
Well, yeah.
Not who Tua is.
But I doubt very seriously if he's trying to get five concussions so he can leave the game and get paid.
I don't know. I mean, it just so it's either that. It's either that explanation, or maybe he's just not – he doesn't have the football smarts, or
Same thing happened to Jim McMahon. He was not a big guy. And once in a while, he'd get clobbered in the days when people could really hurt quarterbacks.
Well, Jim, I don't see Tua being like that macho
The guy got a torn kidney one day, for God's sake.
I know, but Jim McMahon was this crazy alpha male kind of guy that was going to throw himself into a brick wall, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He liked the attention, right?
He was one of your kind of guys. He was from Utah.
Yeah. He was – that's not – well, he was actually a Notre Dame recruit, right? He wanted to go to Notre Dame, but he ended up BYU.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was not a Mormon, was he? I don't think so.
Oh, he was not a Mormon. I think he was Catholic, and he wanted to go to Notre Dame, so he ended up at BYU, right? I think he thought BYU gave him the best shot to get the NFL. But going back to Tua, he's just not that kind of player that is going to run over people, right? And to me, it makes sense for him to slide. If he wants to, and he's had a history, and you know his coaches are telling him.
But there's people that slide, and somebody targets their head, and they get a concussion anyway.
Yeah, that's true, but I mean, but he's aiming his head at the guy's torso, right? Yeah, into that thing, right? He's been coached to do that. Here's a third explanation. I'm a Christian, right? Sometimes Christians, I think that there's this moral hazard, this Christian moral hazard, where, you know, they're told not to fear anything. God will save. God will protect, right? So maybe his thing is God's going to save him, right? So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But his coaches are telling him to slide feet first. Sliding head first in that guy's torso or aiming his head at that guy's torso is going to cause a second or third or fourth concussion. And so, you know, maybe he's like the guy from Buffalo, the quarterback from Buffalo. I think the stage is too big for that guy. Last year in the playoffs, he could have dumped it off. You know, remember that last drive? He could have dumped it off. He could have checked it down, but instead he went to the end zone. If he would have checked it down, they're closer to a field goal, right? They're closer to the field goal if they don't make it on fourth. But if he checks it down over the middle, they have a chance at a better field goal, and they have a chance to win it all out.
I think every no matter who you are, every play you want to have some of it back. I know when I pitch softball,
but some people are just too big. For some people, the moment is just too big.
Well, it's a huge moment, for God's sake.
Yeah,
I mean it's way more than anybody we've ever known is involved in.
Yeah,
you know, it's like all of a sudden you walking out and getting the Nobel Prize for economics. Hey, the moment's too big for hell. Well, it better be. how could it not be too big for you? I mean, it's about as big as it gets.
One, that's never going to happen. Two, if it did happen, I think I'd be like Milton Friedman, except instead of having one person, you know, booing him. Remember that? He had one person booing him. You know, the whole audience would just get up and leave.
God. Well, you know, I'm stunned when I listen to all these debates and listen to all these people. And I know there's a party line about what the Fed's doing, and there's a party line about, you know, who's benefiting by it. But I can't believe you go week after week after week in an election race. And nobody addresses the real cause of what caused all the inflation.
I mean, the debates, not one.
But I'm saying there's nothing.
Monetary policy. Nothing.
But I mean, there's nothing in front of the Fed guy, and he's like, "Well, you know, we have to worry about you know, oil and supply chain. I go, what are you talking about? You put 40% of money into the system.
Yeah. Don't make and it looks like M2. It looks like M2's on a new path.
Oh yeah,
on it's a new straight up. Path that exceeds the pre-pandemic trend.
It's right. It's we're up to. If you take last month's move, it's a 6.7% move annually.
Yeah. The current trend is above the pre-pandemic trend, right. So we're reinflating
without right. a doubt. And while they're telling people they're not, and you yeah. know, and during an election year, I mean, that's I'm saying it is so easy if you're the person who's in there to do that. I mean, does anybody care? I mean, the current administration, but if it was Republican, it wouldn't make any difference.
No, they wouldn't care.
Does anybody care if over the next 60 days you pump money in the economy, make it look good, and get a labor number like last week? I mean,
yeah,
because in your mind,
I'm not too sure that labor number looked too good because you had all these new government jobs, and this is how cynical I've gotten, Tom. This is just how cynical I've gotten. You had this record number of new government jobs, and I asked a question on Twitter: is you know the BLS? I mean, whoever reports these hires, I mean, I don't know how the BLS collects the job numbers from the federal government, but is it possible that the person that reports the government hires for the quarter or for the month, just, you know, like multiplied it by three and gave that to the BLS? I mean, the Federal Reserve prints money. Is it possible they're just printing?
Well, the idea that in 1 month you...
These numbers?
Well, 250,000 people, they only work for 21 days. So what are we talking yeah. about? 20 plus thousand people a day being hired.
Yeah.
And now last month it was half of that. How does that flip? How does that switch get flipped?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, on the 31st, you hire 15,000 or 10,000 people. The next day, you hire
maybe they're part time workers for you know like I don't know.
Well, they are, but that's not this time of the year is not normally the thing. I mean, a lot of it was in medical, a lot of it was in government.
Yeah, but most of it came from government, right? Most of that increase came from government. And so my question is, if the Federal Reserve can just print money to paper over deficits and pay interest on the debt, why can't whoever reports the numbers to the BLS just say, hey, we hired X number of new people last year and that X number doesn't exist?
Well, you wonder if it's actual hirees or if it's people budgeted or what it is. I mean, it should be hirees. It just seems like, you know, 1 month you'll have, sometimes you'll have 1 month we're down 80,000, next month we're up 100,000. Okay, well, last month we fired 5,000 people a day, and all of a sudden this month we're hiring 5,000. It's a big switch.
You know, that government number, I've read things where that government number, that increase in government employees, resulted, it explains most of the drop in the unemployment rate from like 4.3 to 4.1. Some people have suggested that, right? Because it was such a big number. So if you want to make the current administration look good, and I think most people that work in government, I mean, just look at the politics in any capital city in the United States. It could be a red state, it could be a blue state. That capital city is probably 80-60% Democrat, 20%, 40% Republican, that capital city, right? And D.C. is probably 90-10, right? So if that's the case, well, who's working?
Well, at the BLS? I don't know about that. I mean, in Illinois, I'm going to say Springfield's probably Republican.
The city, well, in Utah, you would think Utah's pretty conservative, but in downtown Salt Lake, it's probably 60-40 in Utah. Now you get out into Draper, you get out into the suburbs of Salt Lake City, it's definitely Republican. But in downtown Salt Lake City, it's probably 60-40 swing.
Well, just,
my neighbors, when we lived downtown Salt Lake City, back in 2013, my neighbors were Marxist socialists. They were like, people would hang like these billboards from their porches, you know, talking about how horrible communism is, and all the political signs in the yards that I saw in downtown Salt Lake City, all of them skewed heavily to the Democrats or progressive cause.
Why, question for you, Professor. Why, when I have these you have a conversation with somebody who's conservative or whatever they think they are, because I don't even know what the conservatives think they are these days, but when somebody will say, well, that's, you know, like Kamala Harris, she's a socialist. And I'm going, she's not what you necessarily want economically or me. But you wonder when people use the term socialist, they mean that are that not not their idea of capitalist. But every time a free market economy, if you decide that somebody's doing something other than that, be it medicine, whatever, to say it's socialist, it means that you have no understanding of what a socialist system is.
Yeah.
A socialist system is actually a very structured group of people that say, we've decided that everybody's going to be involved in the same stuff. Now, it may work, it may not work. A lot of it depends on the people themselves and to what degree they push it. I mean, people in Sweden seem reasonably happy with it, although they've got areas where they've come out of that too. But what the system here, I think our system is I'll use the term fascist. Not in the sense that we're putting people on trains, but it's we want three or four companies in every industry with their nose up the ass of government. That's not socialist. That's not free market. It's something, but it's not either one of those, right?
To me, the continuum is not left and right, conservative and progressive. To me, the continuum is on the right, or you could say on the left, but on one side is total zero government, total liberty, period.
No, they
and on the other side is total unapologetic.
No, they want government favoring them and their industry and free for the rest of the industries.
There's a continuum of total liberty and there's total tyranny. And I would say our current form of government is on the side of total tyranny. It's and the Republicans and the Democrats, they're just different versions.
Right,
of it.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
So I mean if you were to have the people in big business, which maybe not anymore, it's not structured this way all the time. The people in big, say the people in the drug companies, they want less government for everybody else, not for them.
No, they want government protection so they can charge greater.
Yeah, they want government protection. What is the line I heard in college? Was I don't know, it was Milton Friedman? Somebody said it. Competition is the greatest thing in the world for every business, but every industry but ours, because we got all these cutthroat competitors that don't play fair or something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, I came to that conclusion when this Kenyon came to speak at A&T. The last year I was there, the first time around in 2013, she's a lawyer from Kenya, and she came in. And at that point, I was questioning my economics at that point. And I'd never got an undergraduate degree in economics. I was never baptized in the faith of mainstream economic thinking. I took a bunch of math classes. I took one or two econ classes in undergrad. Then I took math econ in graduate school in mathematics. And that led me to a PhD in economics. And while I was teaching macro, I started questioning all the assumptions. Because in math, a great theorem is one with minimal amount of assumptions. But in economics, a macro theorem or a microeconomics theorem has all kinds of assumptions. And the biggest assumption is the ceteris paribus assumption. I'm sorry, things are just not held constant. They're not held constant for 10 minutes, right? So I started really questioning it. When she came to speak to us, she was a true libertarian. She was a Murray Rothbard type libertarian. And that's when I realized that just what you said there, I discovered it on my own. People, pro-business politicians, the businesses that support those politicians, they love free markets in terms of the resources they have to acquire and hire.
Without a doubt.
But when it comes to their output markets, they want protection from government, and government rules, regulations, taxes, subsidies, all that stuff creates barriers to entry. And that's when I really divorced myself from this mainstream economic thinking. And that's when I really said, I'm not interested in a job advising Republicans. I'm not interested in a job advising Democrats. That's when I basically gave up any thought of doing that away, when I realized that.
But if we go that route the whole way, I think we end up not being ourselves. And I think I don't know if I got the 40-year plan on me, but probably not. Maybe not even the 30, but still, I honestly think that if America allows itself, the U.S. of A. allows itself to go down, it'll be a disaster that the world will come back for centuries.
Well, I think it's just inevitable. I mean, you look at history, it's just inevitable.
Well, it's not empires. Inevitable. I mean, it. Yeah, but this time, well, yeah, look what happened when Rome went down. The dark ages. Do we want those again?
But you know, the funny thing about the collapse of Rome, if you look at what happened in Italy after the collapse of Rome, what happened is you combine the individual salvation. Christianity led to two different schools of thinking. You know, all the people that hate socialism who are Christian, Christianity in Rome and Europe led to two different schools of thinking. It led to this socialism, Christian utopian socialism, and then it also led to free market capitalism. Because you mix in this individual salvation with the property rights that were a hangover policy from the collapse of the Roman Empire, that was still in place. So you had these property rights. You had this, all individuals are equal under the eyes of God. And then on top of that, Italy was surrounded by all these international ports. So there was access to trade. Those three things kind of sparked the market economy. Meanwhile, the Christian utopian movements, the socialist movements, are the things that fed the ideas of Marx through Hegel. And so you have these two schools of thought that today appear to oppose each other.
We got a dash, Al, but I think you skipped about 500 years.
I only had like a minute.
Yeah, I'm saying the Dark Ages were just that, the Dark Ages, right? Nothing happened between the Rome and the
Well, I think the Dark Ages also coincided with a global cool down where a lot of crops died and people were malnutritioned. And there was a lot of disease.
We'll talk about that next week. Did you ever read a book called Catastrophe?
I haven't read it, huh?
Oh, God. You check that out. It's really something.
Okay. I'll look at it this weekend.
Especially look at the chapter on when it cooled down, about 48 different species of rats made it a little further than they normally did out of Africa. So when they finally got on the boats to Rome, they had the bubonic plague, which normally was contained.
Yeah.
Ugh. I didn't know there were that many species of rats in Africa. Just saying. How's it going on that thought? SP Futures up 21. NASDAQ Futures up 70. See if we can bounce back all the way from yesterday. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.